Hi there. I'm Annie Corrigan, and this is Earth Eats.
You can see images of a big, long table with the family all standing behind it, the food all spread out on the table. And underneath the table are a few of these oak rod baskets.
John Kay of Traditional Arts Indiana explains why the craft of farmers making oak rod baskets has mostly faded away. We visit the Illinois State Fair to hear the sounds of chainsaw artwork. From Harvest Public Media, what if farmers were able to turn a profit on their cover crops? And then cooking green beans, Daniel Orr starts with a basic blanching in hot water, and then it's into an ice bath.
We want it to be real, real cold, so bring down the temperature of those green beans, hold in all their nutrients, and also keep their nice, vibrant green color.
But he's not done there. We've got several ideas for serving green beans on today's show. Here's a check-in with Mark Chilla for the week's news.
Consumers will soon see the letters NO and GMO on more food packages. The USDA issued a guidance last week that will allow meat, poultry, and egg products to be labeled as non-GMO, using phrases like no GMO ingredients or derived from beef fed no GMO feed. The guidance is one of the federal department's first actions, stemming from the GMO labeling law enacted in July that requires some products made with GMOs to be labeled through a variety of ways. To label a product as non is a negative claim. Prior to the guidance, the USDA's Food Safety and Inspection Service only allowed the use of the phrases GMO and genetically modified organism on livestock or poultry products if it was a part of the name of a third-party certifying organization, like the Non-GMO Project. The guidance does not specify the allowable limit of trace GMO content in food, though it does adopt the federal law's definition of bioengineering. And if you go to New England expecting to eat mussels, scientists say you might soon be out of luck. The wild blue mussels that used to cover two-thirds of the Gulf of Maine tidal zone are disappearing, according to a study by University of California, Irvine marine ecologists. The mussels now cover less than 15% of the tidal zone. That's a 60% population decline over the past 40 years. Just last week, thousands of dead mussels washed up on the shores of Long Island. Scientists believe the massive die-off is due to increases in human harvesting, predatory invasive species, and warmer water temperatures. Most mussels consumed by humans are farmed in aquaculture operations, but they depend on wild mussel larvae to grow. EarthEats.org is the place to go to read more. We post even more food and farming stories on Twitter, at EarthEats.
And that's Mark Chilla. Thanks for giving voice to our food news.
Glad to do it.
Carnival barkers, livestock shows. Walk through the state fair this summer and you might hear something else. Chainsaws buzzing. For Harvest Public Media, Rich Egger went to an Illinois fair and found wood carvers from all over the Midwest wielding chainsaws, transforming blocks of wood into pieces of art.
I'm Sam Dunning from Benton, Kentucky. You know, I had a guy interview me years ago and he said, you know, secretly I think everybody wants to be a chainsaw carver. And I thought it was funny at the time he said it, but you know, I tell people, go try it. I mean, what are you going to do? You can always roast weenies over it when you're done if you don't like what it turned out as.
I am Sandy Songer from Broken Bow, Oklahoma. We have been carving, my husband and I are here together. We have been carving for 16 years. We take full logs and we make mostly animals out of them. We've got cowboys and we've got Indians and we've got wolves and Sasquatches. We've got all kinds of things out here for people to see. We have to do a lot of bears because the public wants bears. It's been a little different up here in the north. Well, I call this the north. Everybody seems to want farm animals. They want pigs and they want ears of corn. And you can't sell a pig or an ear of corn where I'm from. So that's really different for us. But they still buy a lot of bears up here too. If you're gonna stay around us very long, you need to put some earplugs in.
I'm Matthew Loper from Grandview, Indiana. I like a lot of mythical stuff, dragons, different things like that, but I carve a lot of flowers and tropical stuff too. This saw here I do mainly most of my blocking out with. Oh. most of the blocking out with. Blocking out is you're not doing all the detail as you work your way down the log. You bring out mainly what you want, and then you go in and you tune it in to make it look like what it's supposed to look like. This one's for just detail. That dime tip on there, it's as big as a dime. So you can really get in and make places for the eyes, get facial features, different things like that. Get in between the claws on birds and different things. It's really really helpful.
I'm Chainsaw Willie from Grandview, Indiana. Well, you just take a log and you pick out what you want to do with it, how whatever size of log you want to use to fit your animal that you want to carve, and then you just, me, I just vision what I want to see, and then I might scratch a little bit of it on there to get my bearings, and then it's all over after that with the chainsaw. It happens pretty quick, you know.
I'm Ben Reynolds from Glasgow, Pennsylvania. This competition is judged by, like, the end of the auction. They'll add up all the pieces and everything, and whoever has the highest percentage ends up winning. But, you know, a lot of them are judged, you know, at competitions. They have artists come in and judge you from 1 to 10, and that's how a lot of those go. But this is basically money-based, how much you can make.
It's auction time. We're going to try to get through these as fast as we can. We've got about 129 pieces to sell, so we're going to try to move as fastly as we can. Let's go. All right, we're going to sell this little bear here with the football. Dub Bears selling the little bear with the football. It's item number 80, Stevie Songer. Item 80, $100 where?
I'm Mary Butler from Mendon, Illinois.
Have you bought anything?
Not yet, but prices are going up.
2 1/4?
Yeah.
2 1/4, looking for 250.
Plan on getting a hold of some of the carvers, though, maybe, and, you know, ordering something.
Looking for 475 twice. Sold at $450. Buyer number 139. Thank you. Long creating paper.
Thanks to Rich Egger of Harvest Public Media for that story. See pictures at eartheats.org. John Kay came into the Earth Eats studios this week with a basket. It was a wooden basket, medium-sized, woven. He told me to grab it and squeeze it to feel how strong it was. It didn't even make that creaking noise you associate with wood baskets. It was just firm.
This is a basket that my great-great-grandmother used to both feed the chickens and to gather eggs in.
So how many eggs, how many dozens of eggs could we put in there? 4 dozen eggs, do you think?
Well, I think probably more. You're looking at 5 or 6 easily.
He's the director of Traditional Arts Indiana. His latest project looks at the history of these oak rod baskets in Brown County, Indiana. When his grandmother gave him this basket, she also gave him a picture of his great-great-grandmother using it. The photo probably dates from around 1919. He can't tell if she's feeding the chickens or collecting the eggs, but it's clearly a tool for her farm work in Heltonville, Indiana.
They work out real well. They feel good on the hand, better than that little plastic spindly piece on a 5-gallon bucket when you go. So,
putting in the crook of your elbow, I would imagine, too, that, yeah. So free up both of your hands to do some things, and I'm
exactly.
Imagining.
And the nature of the way it's made, you think about what happens when you set down your 5-gallon bucket, the handle flops over. This, if you're constantly moving through the field, you're just kind of moving this along with you, and the handle's always in the same place.
This is an oak rod basket. She didn't make it herself, but someone did. Kay says all baskets, even today, are made by hand. She probably bought it from someone she knew, maybe a farmer neighbor who made these in his spare time. You can imagine just how much force and effort it must have taken to weave the strands of wood into the basket.
This one is an oval-shaped basket. Looks kind of like a willow basket, but it's made with these long white oak rods, which the makers would have pulled through these dies to kind of render the splits of white oak into a round form. And it made for a very strong, sturdy basket. And then it's got a single handle over the top that they would have wrapped, or they did wrap, with white oak all the way around it to make it kind of smooth and stronger. The ones that were intended for heavier use, they would have twisted as well as wrapped around them to make them extra strong and sturdy.
And we're talking turn of the century when people are making and using these?
Yeah, this would have been, well, the tradition was brought to Brown County in about 1848 and continued robustly until probably after World War II. There were men, almost exclusively men, that made these baskets in this region, and they were listed in census records as basket makers. So where all their neighbors were farmers, and they were probably farmers, day laborers as well, they considered themselves basket makers.
Kay tracks oak rod baskets back to three families, the Hovises, the Bohalls, and the Morgans. Henry Hovis was the man who brought the tradition to Brown County in 1848. George Bohall taught his five sons how to make baskets. That family was so famous, oak rod baskets were often called Bohall baskets. A bit later on, Rube Morgan and his family got into basketry. These were sold to hardware stores, to their neighbors.
And how do we find out about how these baskets were used? We can see them in museums. We can see them in thrift shops and those sort of things. But we don't understand that much about it. So what I've done is I've kind of combed through historic photographs and found images of the Ping family gathering hickory nuts near their home. You can see the shagbark hickory trees all around them. And you see two of these oak rod baskets on the forest floor there as they're sitting around gathering up the hickory nuts. You can see images of near Stonehead of a big long table with the family all standing behind it, the food all spread out on the table. And underneath the table, nicely tucked away, are a few of these oak rod baskets. They would have carried these baskets full of food to important family gatherings when they went. So these would have been just an ever-present, constant part of everyday life for a lot of folks in this region.
That was in the 20s and 30s. Then big city tourists started visiting Brown County and wanting these baskets as souvenirs. Demand went up. But then after World War II...
there were a lot fewer of these type of baskets and more fancy baskets that were being brought up from Kentucky and Tennessee that were being made primarily by women that with fancy plated handles and decorative rims for them instead of the work baskets that the locals used and made.
And in terms of using the baskets for farm work, they just didn't make sense anymore by the 50s and 60s. There were plastic buckets and cardboard boxes and canvas bags. Nowadays, we've sort of come full circle. It's charming to carry a basket to the farmer's market. Knitters and crafters will use baskets like these for their materials.
There are people all over this region now that are collecting these oak rod baskets. They've become very kind of highly desirable. Now in an antique mall, I can still find them for $15 or $20, you know. But if someone knows what they are, they're selling for $100 or $300 for a big laundry basket or something like that. But I always don't think about the money part of it. I think about the labor part of it. And I think about, you know, the fact that we have this tradition here in Indiana and we let it go. But we're not alone. There was about six or seven states that had small pockets where oak rod baskets were made. And as far as I can tell, I've asked around, I think it's pretty much gone everywhere.
It's hard to know when the craft really stopped. The way Kay describes it is it just sort of faded away. One of the last basket makers he tracked down was Bruce Hovis, Henry's grandson. He made baskets through the 80s, and so did a grandson of George Bohall. But that was the generation that didn't pass on the skill to their kids. Kay speculates it was because the lure of better money doing less strenuous work in the city was more enticing. All this research Kay has been doing will be on display at Indiana University's Mathers Museum through next February. Through his work, he managed to track down another descendant of the Brown County basket makers.
I actually went to talk with Claude Morgan, Rube Morgan's son, who actually made one basket when he was a kid. He's probably the last of the makers, you might say, even though he says he's not a basket maker. He made one.
Kay asked to see the place where Rube Morgan did his work back in the turn of the century.
Because our family doesn't own that property anymore.
Kay insisted because he knew Morgan used to write his patterns on the wall where he worked.
And he goes, what? I don't know what you're talking about. And he goes, let's go see if we can find it. And we went to the barn. Now, this guy died in 1981 and went to the barn where he used to work, asked the people who own the property now. And I go in there, and on his wall, on the door jamb, and on post of the walls of his barn, he has all the materials written out, what links, how many rods, what length of the rods they needed to be, what you start with pattern for each one of his baskets. You know, if you needed to make a laundry basket, if you needed to make a hamper, if you needed to make a baby basket, if you needed to make all these different forms that he had, the recipes, you might say, right there on the wall of the barn.
Jackpot. He snapped pictures so he could analyze Morgan's process and write up his recipes. The current owners say Kay got there just in time. They had been thinking about putting a fresh coat of paint on that wall. John Kay is a professor of practice at Indiana University. See a picture of him with his great-great-grandmother's oak rod basket at eartheats.org. In a bit, recipes with green beans. Sautéed and deep-fried. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From vegetarian to paleo and low carb, taste matters, your taste. Current truck location is available at whereisurgent.com. You're with Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Grain farmers across the Midwest look for the best way to grow a profitable crop. Right now, they face lower corn, soybean, and wheat prices, and ongoing pressure to keep chemicals they apply to fields from running off into nearby water. All of that is prompting some to take a closer look at oats, a crop most abandoned decades ago. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports.
On a hot, high summer day in Boone County, Iowa, Brett Heineman waits for his uncle to unload a red case combine. He's shuttling the loads to the local co-op. They're harvesting the first crop of oats on this farm in decades. Before corn and soybeans completely covered the landscape, most Corn Belt farmers also grew oats or alfalfa. Heineman barely remembers the last time they grew oats, when he was just a kid.
I just remember putting in the bales up there. That was not a very fun job.
This time, they've hired someone to bale the oat straw, which they've also sold.
That was our biggest worry, if we were going to be able to get rid of the straw or not.
Sure.
So we were more than happy to get rid of it.
Yeah.
Oats may not be super profitable here. Prices are typically low, but they're an investment. This field often floods, which cuts down on the yield of corn or soybeans. But since the oats get harvested early, the family has time to make improvements. They hope updating the drainage lines here will reduce excess water. That could translate to more profit from the money-making crops in the future. Sarah Carlson of Practical Farmers of Iowa runs a pilot project to see whether oats can regain a place in the Corn Belt grain rotation.
Having land open for some sort of maintenance in August is a really great idea. And so that maintenance might be like physical dozer maintenance,
like the Heinemans have planned.
But that maintenance might also be soil health improvements or breaking pest cycles.
Oats are a popular cover crop, something farmers put on their fields to keep them green in late fall and early spring. Cover crops prevent erosion and keep nitrogen in place. But typically they are killed when it's time to plant the cash crop. Giving oats a full season's go offers farmers a product to sell, too, if they can sell the grain and the straw, like the Heinemans. And that early harvest means oat fields are available for more diverse cover crop mixes, which further enhance the soil for future crops.
In our oat pilot project, I have some farmers that are really excited about this soil health idea and planting these crazy, sexy, large cover crop mixes.
These can include sun hemp and clover, which are legumes that fix nitrogen in the soil, keeping it out of streams and available to the next year's corn. Carlson points to research from Matt Liebman at Iowa State University. He says the sale price of oats can make them look unprofitable, But when they are companion cropped with these nitrogen-fixing plants, so both are on the field during a year off from corn or soybeans, it's a lot cheaper to grow corn the following year.
The production costs for corn within that whole rotation system can drop substantially so that the overall economics of the rotation are favorable.
More simply, a farmer can spend a lot less on fertilizer for corn the next year. And that can make a big difference to the bottom line. Carlson wants to shift the conversation so farmers see oats first as a boon to their corn fields.
We need to think of oats as a way to grow cheaper nitrogen.
Secondly, oats are a cash crop. They're sold as seed for cover crops or as livestock feed. Midwest farmers won't be growing your oatmeal anytime soon, but Carlson hopes that market will eventually open up to them.
Right now, the combine's driving itself.
For now, Paul Heineman, Brett's uncle, is happy to watch the many monitors in the air-conditioned cab of his combine as another load fills the bin behind him.
It knows where it's been better than I do.
Later, he and his family will figure out whether oats make sense in their rotation.
So do you think y'all will have to wait until after you've done your corn and soybeans this year and you look at all your numbers to decide if the oats have been worth it?
Yeah, that's what we'll probably do.
They may even need the data from next year's corn to truly calculate the value oats bring to the farm. But already, Heineman says, these oats look pretty good. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Get more food and ag stories from this reporter collective at harvestpublicmedia.org. It's a day of green beans in the Farm Bloomington kitchen. We have two different ways to prepare them and two different chefs. First, it's Daniel Orr.
One thing that we talk a lot about in Earth Eats is blanching and shocking. And so that's what we're going to do today. We've got some nice salted boiling water. You drop your green beans in there or any kind of green vegetable, whether it's broccoli or asparagus. And what you want to do is totally submerge your vegetable in the boiling salted water, and you're gonna let that cook for about 2 to 3 minutes, okay? And then the other half of that is the shocking part. In this bin over here, we have ice water. You can see the nice ice cubes in here. We want it to be real, real cold, so it'll bring down the temperature of those green beans, hold in all their nutrients, and also keep their nice, vibrant green color. All right, I'm just going to give these a little sample taste. Okay, perfect. And we'll move on to the next step of these nice sautéed long beans. We've got a nice hot pan. You could use a wok if you're so inclined. A little bit of oil. I'm going to add garlic. Very, very hot. Ginger. I don't want my stuff to burn here. So I'm going to quickly add my long beans. Okay, stir them around. Okay, the whole thing is very quick cooking. You're getting kind of a toasted garlic flavor. Since the beans are already cooked, all we need to do is really reheat them. I'm going to add some other ingredients. Got some bamboo shoots, some water chestnuts, and some cherry tomatoes, and those are just going to give me some nice color. And then for seasoning, got some toasted sesame seeds. Okay, so it's really starting to look like an Asian stir fry. And this is great for a side dish, or you could add some firm tofu to this and you'd have a main course. Okay, serve it family style. You smell that toasty garlic and the sesame. Okay, we're just gonna put some lemon wedges around it. Perfect for a nice low-cal, quick weekday dinner.
Where are we doing this at? Right here? Back by the fryer. Yes, Chef. We're going to the fryer.
Chef Bob Atkins is up.
This is where the magic happens.
The deep frying.
The deep fry. This is where the thousands and thousands of our farm famous Parmesan and garlic chili fries come from.
I thought you were going to say thousands and thousands of calories.
Deep fat, lots of calories, but If done correctly, deep fat frying can actually be fairly healthy. It doesn't absorb a lot of oil and grease if you don't have a real thick batter. And if you do the appropriate steps so it doesn't absorb the oil, basically you're just immersing it into a really hot environment and steaming it from the inside out. So, we're gonna start by making our batter. And you wanna make your batter not too far in advance, no more really than an hour or so. So starting with some all-purpose flour, we're gonna add to this cornstarch. And the cornstarch makes things extra crisp and light. We're gonna add a little bit of sugar for some sweetness, add some salt. If we wanted to, we could add any number of things to this. We could put some cayenne, we could put some chili powder, some sesame seeds, some sesame oil, things like that. I mean, this is just, like we like to do here, we like to take a really basic recipe and then we build on that. And I think that's what all good cooks should do at home as well. So I'm just using my hand, mixing all my dry ingredients together. And then I have one beaten egg. Get really beat up together there. Some tempura recipes don't call for any egg, but this is just going to ensure that's going to stick and stay together in the fryer. And then we're going to add some beer to our dry ingredients. That was about a cup of really ice cold beer, nice and cold. If you don't have the beer, you could use soda water. And the consistency is like a little bit thicker than crepe batter, a little thinner than pancake batter. It's okay if you got a few clumps. I'm using my hands here just to make sure that, you know, I'm getting them pretty well. So it should coat your fingers when you come up out of the batter. All right, so we've got our green beans here. Nice, fresh out of the garden green beans. I'm gonna toss them in a little bit of flour or cornstarch and drop them right down on the batter. Give them a quick toss. Whoa, it's all right. Frying is usually messy. I think that's why people go out to restaurants for fried foods, because it is. It's greasy and it's messy. Okay, 350 degree fat. Just gonna drop these in one by one. You don't want them to clump together in the fryer. And you can see they've got this beautiful light brown batter on them, but you can still see a little bit of the green. So now out of the oil, and then we're gonna just put them onto a plate or into a bowl. Line with a little bit of paper towel, soak up any extra fat or grease, and then we'll just dust a little bit of kosher salt right over that, and then dip them in whatever you want.
Like homemade ketchup or beet vinaigrette or a green goddess dressing? Recipes galore at eartheats.org. We're getting ready to record even more recipes with Daniel and the crew at Farm, and we want your requests. What ingredients do you want recipes for? Squash? Kale? Maybe turnips? Tell us on Twitter. We are at Earth Eats. From Twitter to the website to the podcast, our crew makes it all happen. Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killow, Daniel Orr, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. The executive producer of Earth Eats is John Bailey. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From gluten-free to kosher and halal. Food for everyone, everywhere. Full menu and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. And from Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington, independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. I'm Annie Corrigan. See you same time next week.